Hello and welcome to Against the Law, the ancient history podcast that aims to separate fact from fiction. Today we're embarking on the second of our scientific trio of episodes, and I'm hoping you'll have a good reaction to the topic we're covering today. My three history boffins have passed the acid test to make great strides in dispelling ancient history myths, and what's more, they've got great chemistry. We've all bonded over our love of the ancient world, so let me introduce the team. Xenia is in her element when it comes to talking about the ancient Romans. Meg is the absolute salt of the earth, and she's got some info for us on the ancient Greeks. And Barney is ready to bung a load of facts about the ancient Near East our way. I'm Flo, and I'm likely to singe my fringe on a Bunsen burner due to my density, but I'm ready to learn all about ancient chemistry with you, dear listener. Okay, so chemistry. So where does sort of chemistry as a concept start then? Because I know I'm thinking about sort of how you might make sense of how things are constructed, how things are built up. Meg, I think you've got something to share about atoms, maybe.
Yeah, I've got loads to share about atoms, but I actually wanted to start with like pre-atoms, before atoms. So like the headline fact here is that the Greeks kind of got atoms. They kind of worked out what was going on. They got some stuff wrong. Obviously, they're not perfect. Even Homer nods is an expression, which means that even Homer gets stuff wrong. In this case, it wasn't Homer. It was the people on more of the sciencey side, but they did get stuff wrong. Anyway, there were people who, before this sort of atomic theory arose, there was like a few people who I just wanted to name drop because I think there's some quite cool ideas. So basically, this is all coming under the bracket of sort of matter theory, like what is the world made of? And that's a massive question, obviously. You don't need me to tell you that, guys. Huge question. And it's related to the question of where does the world come from? So that's more of us almost like a physics side to this question. But there were a few different ideas. So a guy called Thales of Miletus in like the 7th, 6th century BC, so very, very early, thought that everything was made from water. He thought that water was the sort of original principle that everything else comes from. Anaximander, who I mentioned last week, was a little bit later on, kind of later in the 6th century, thought that everything came not from water, but from this thing which is translated as like the boundless or the infinite. It's quite vague. He's sort of basically like, there's something that's everything, nothing, it's not, it's infinite, it's limitless, and then everything comes from that. So that's a bit like, not quite sure what's going on there. Don't know if that's, it's not as specific as the other ones. And then I was also looking at Parmenides, who's quite famous. It was a sort of 5th century. Still pre-Socratic. These are all pre-Socrates, and that's quite a big distinction. And he was like, rejected the existence of change and motion. And it's this early version of like a theory of monism. So he was like, everything is just made of one thing and always has been. And he completely rejected any kind of empirical understanding of the world, because you could be like, well, I've experienced change and motion. He was like, no, pure logic, everything must have always been and is always the same. I think he was probably quite annoying at parties because he was just like, no, nothing that you've experienced means anything. It's all abstract logic.
I like that he's rejecting outright that theory. I refuse to believe that. That's how I felt about my GCSEs, but unfortunately that doesn't fly in a exam setting.
I've got a friend who argues constantly that everything is mustard.
Okay.
Yeah. I think he discovered that there's quite a lot of vegetables and stuff like that are like in the mustard family.
Right.
And sort of extrapolated from that not only surprising other vegetables, like, you know, the, I don't know, Romesco or something is mustard, but then everything else must be mustard as well, because if all of these things are surprisingly mustard, then why not, you know, the rest of reality?
Excellent.
Fair, totally fair.
I think that is kind of the vibe for these like pre-atomic theories of matter, is it's kind of spin a wheel, see what thing comes up. Water, okay, great. Air, yep, sounds good. Limitless everything, or just nothing ever changing stuff. That's kind of those options. So it's very, very much like, what's the world made of? We don't know. Let's pick a random thing. No, that's a bit harsh. They did have a bit more going on. But yeah, I thought those were quite interesting. That's like pre-atoms. Would you like to hear about the atoms?
Oh, yes, please.
You're gonna lose your minds. So there's two guys, big atom guys, Leucippus and Democritus. They kind of have a Socrates-Plato dynamic. We don't know much about Leucippus, but we know quite a lot about Democritus, and he wrote everything down. And they basically were atomists, and they thought, well, everything must be made of something, and you can't keep dividing things infinitely. You can't keep getting smaller and smaller. So there must be a smallest unit, and that smallest unit must be indivisible. And they thought that was an they called it an atomos. An atomos literally means indivisible. The A is just a negating thing, like asexual. And then temno is to cut. And then temno becomes sort of tomnos and then tomos. So atomos, indivisible, which I just think is really freaky. It's like, it's kind of like a Chekhov's gun. It's like big old sign on this thing saying, can't split this. Don't split it. What would happen if you did? Terrible, bad. Like that can't happen. And then that's the atom. And we went and split it, guys. So I just think that's weird. They literally called it like, don't split this one up. And that's, and they, you know, they got it. They got it right. Like they, there were some bits that weren't quite right. But that's pretty much the atom.
That's not too far off. I mean, we didn't know what would happen when we split the atom. Do you remember there are a load of people who were very concerned that we might just disappear into a black hole of our own making at that point?
Yeah.
And then we found out that that's actually fusion, not fission.
One final fun fact for you. Guess what shape Plato thought atoms were?
Square.
Hexagons.
Elephant.
Elephant and hexagons, both... wrong. Triangles. He thought they were, atoms were triangular. So he was a geometrical atomist.
They do tessellate.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's what he was going for. He thought that they were just really nutty. He loved triangles, so they were beautiful. And he thought that there was kind of a creationist god. I feel like that's something we don't often talk about with Plato. He thought, well, it might be an allegory. It's kind of like the Genesis debate. Is it literal or is it an allegory? But he thought that someone, or a skilled craftsman god, kind of created all the triangles so they all fit together, right? And they make up everything. And he was obviously wrong about that. And that was later. Leucippus and Democritus got it exactly right. And then Plato was like, what about triangles? And he was so wrong.
It's nice with those theories that you were talking about, that some are sort of right and wrong or could maybe be interpreted as correct given modern scientific understanding, but like wasn't necessarily understood why it was right at the time. Like with the atom thing, you know, you said they essentially put up a big sign saying, do not split this thing, and then it was split. But like that logic of there being an indivisible unit, you know, in reality is still true, even if it's not the atom, you know, like with, you know, things like when you get down to like quantum physics stuff and Planck constants and the Planck length, you know, like the smallest possible length in the universe, like that feels very similar.
Planck length. There's a joke in here. Hang on.
2x4.
I was going to say, when you're a pirate and you know you have to jump into the sea, the plank length is the shortest possible. No, the 2x4 is funnier.
Plank with a C, isn't it, Barney? CK.
Yeah, Max Planck.
Plank.
Maximum Planck.
Maxi Planck.
I wear those sometimes when I've got a heavy flight. Okay, let's move on. So presumably all of these atoms jiggled and wiggled together to make different kinds of elements. I love elements. I used to know the periodic table off by heart, despite having no interest in chemistry, because I just really like the words. I liked ytterbium, which comes from a place in Sweden, I think, and Rutherfordium. I just quite like how people change surnames into words. And I was particularly interested in, for example, gold. Gold being AU on the periodic table instead of GO, which I might expect. I think tin is something like PB, like plum bum. That seems to be tickling a memory from when we did the Great Cloaca sewage pipe. But let's talk about elements a little bit, and I've started with metals. Does anyone have any fun metal facts for us? Barney, I think you might.
I think when thinking chemically, metals are very important to the history of the ancient Near East, and yeah, the history of technology in general. Like, you know, if we think about how we break down periods of ancient history into the Stone Age and then the Bronze Age and then the Iron Age, that's because of metal technologies evolving over time. And these metals were very, very important. So, start with gold. Gold, very, very valuable throughout history. Highly prized in Egypt, and also abundant in Egypt, which is convenient. They thought that gold was the skin of the gods. The gods would sort of glow with the radiance of gold.
That is rather lovely.
So is, like, the gold that you find, like, when you pan in rivers, is that deity dandruff?
That's brilliant. Just like gold.
Nice.
Silver also had a role to play in the divine biology. Silver was the bones of the gods. I think I'd probably rather have calcium, to be honest, than silver in my bones. But I guess you could maybe, you know, chop a limb or something to sell it if you were hard up for cash. Silver was actually rarer than gold in Egypt because it wasn't so abundant there, and at times was worth up to 50 times what gold was.
See, this is what I think it should be worth. I think silver's way better than gold. Gold's super malleable. Sure, it doesn't tarnish, whatever, but silver's there, and it's sturdier, and it's also quite... I think it's prettier than gold, in my personal opinion.
What about white gold?
Yeah, that's just a way to get people to spend more on silver-looking items.
Hmm. Strong opinions here, Flo. Didn't realise this was a passion of yours.
Yeah, and rose gold can get in the sea.
Are you team copper all the way?
I'm team copper all the way. Rose gold is just a way for people to sell iPhones to people who are bored of gold.
If a man is tired of gold, he's tired of life. That's what they say.
Is it? When have they said that, Meg? When? So my strong opinions aside, silver being more expensive than gold, I find that really quite interesting because the bones of the gods. Is that more valuable than their skin? I suppose so.
Ooh.
The economy of the divine body. Mm.
Oh, Barney, that was a beautiful phrase. Write that down. Like
that's a PhD subtitle there.
Yeah, the economy of the divine body. Holy shit.
Poo.
All right. Oh, holy shit.
Poo.
That's from the divine body.
Blimey. Okay, yes. So I think it's not necessarily reflected. Gold was very valuable in the ancient Near East, where there is less of it outside of Egypt. But they traded in a lot of silver. But the Sumerian word for silver is kubabar, which means shining metal, which I think is very nice. Whereas the word for gold is just yellow metal. So I like the feeling. Maybe they're on the flow line here of they're a bit more into their silver, you know, like beautiful and shining, not just yellow.
I think we would have got on well.
Moving away from these precious metals, obviously two very, very important metals in the history of the ancient Near East are copper and tin, because those are the two metals that go into making bronze. And there's a really, really brilliant shipwreck. I think I've spoken about this before. The Uluburun shipwreck, very much a regular fixture, I think, on Against the Law. We love the Uluburun shipwreck. This was a Bronze Age trading ship that went down just off the coast of Turkey, maybe around 1400 BC. And it was carrying a lot of raw materials and exotic items, trade goods and stuff like that. But what's brilliant is that the ratio of copper to tin on board the ship, of which there were tons and tons of both, was about in 10 to 1, which is the ratio that you need for making bronze as well. So I really love that sort of little technological detail there, that of course you'd ship the sort of the correct ratios, because the demand for copper would be 10 times as much as the demand for tin.
Well, let's not forget the complaint letter to Ioannisia, which is, what is it, the world's oldest complaint letter?
Yeah, I've never really understood the sort of memification of this letter. It's certainly not the world's oldest, I don't think. It's just one of many. And this is like an incredibly common type of tablet.
Did you see the meme about it, though, that was like someone now complaining about bad quality metal? And it was like, you know, in Star Wars, it was like, somehow Palpatine has returned. It was like, somehow Ioannisia has returned.
Oh, that's nice. But yes, yeah, so those letters attest, I think, to the importance of these metals. You know, they were constantly being traded and moved around in the ancient Near East. But if we want to get more into the etymology of metals, I think a good one to land on is copper.
Copernicus?
Not Copernicus. There's one island in the Mediterranean that has its name is cognate with the word copper.
Cyprus,
exactly. And I think that's not. I think that's just because the metal is the sort of the Cyprus metal rather than the island being named copper, I think. But there's a lot of copper on Cyprus, and that's why it has that association. Did anyone see Cyprus's flag parade moment on Eurovision?
No.
So everyone was parading their flags, you know, very large, sort of 2 or 3 meter wide, big flowing, rippling flags, and then the Cyprus Act came on, and we had a tiny little like postcard size. Cyprus flag on a stick.
Nice.
Didn't see that.
The flag of Cyprus is just the island of Cyprus.
It does what it says on the tin. This is who we are. This is where we are.
Does what it says on the copper.
Oh, yes, of course.
Very good. Very good.
Thank you, thank you. But then moving on from bronze, as the ancients did, eventually to iron, because iron working technologies sort of came about in the first millennium BC, I think. So generally people think of iron being used later in history. So when a lot of the big achievements of Egypt and the ancient Near East have already been done. But they did have iron in the Bronze Age as well. And one of the excellent sources of iron in the second millennium BC was meteoritic iron. So iron that had smashed into Earth and then been discovered in craters.
Sick.
That is sick. Did they know it was like from the gods, or did they just think it was cool that it was in the ground?
I think it was suspected of being, from the heavens. And there's a very, very famous meteoritic iron object in the grave of Tutankhamun. One of his daggers is made of iron, and it's really beautiful, golden handle. I think it has a rock crystal pommel. Pommel's a sword, isn't it? But yeah, that's sort of at the very end of the dagger. But yes, this is Tutankhamun's space dagger. It's brilliant.
That's literally the coolest thing I've ever heard in my life.
That's a really good comic book title, isn't it? Tutankhamun Space Dagger.
Yes, or like a Doctor Who episode. That is wicked.
That is cool.
So yes, so iron was around before the Iron Age. There we go.
That is pretty cool. Okay. Meg, I think you've got something juicy to share about that.
Juicy, juicy metals. Yeah, so like as Barney said, it's so important, this sort of technological shift from using bronze to using iron. And my understanding of it, again, I feel like Xenia, our chemistry expert, might know more, but my understanding is that you have to heat the metals, right, to get the metal from the ore. And bronze, as we've been speaking about, is an alloy of copper and tin. So they had to get two different types of metal to make it into this really kind of useful tool. And then iron is one type of metal, but it's much more difficult to extract from the rock to get out of the ore. So that's why it took longer for them to do it. And it's actually not as good for making kind of armor and stuff as bronze. I'm not sure why. I'm not an expert in armor making, as that might be a surprise, but that's not my technicality. But it's just much more abundant, so there was less need to trade for it. So that's a massive shift for the Greeks, is going from like trading to get bronze versus being able to get iron a lot more easily. But the other thing I just wanted to quickly mention is that this is really relevant for Homer. Because you can quite, some people have argued that you can almost track the movement from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age in the Homeric epics, because they're set right at the end of the Bronze Age in an event, the Trojan War, which is possibly, if we understand it as a historical event, part of the Bronze Age collapse. So part of this kind of big transition period for basically the entire Mediterranean. And there's more references to bronze in the Iliad than there are in the Odyssey. So some people have tried to argue that you can almost see the sort of transition, that the bronze giving way to iron in the Iliad, which is earlier, a lot of people have argued, compared to the Odyssey. And the kind of the flip side to that is a lot of people have used that to say that the Odyssey was actually composed kind of significantly later. It's also set afterwards, obviously. It's a sequel. So I thought that was really cool.
Dating literature by our technological advancements. That's kind of cool. I want to hop back a little bit to precious metals, because Xenia, I know that you've got some shiny facts for us about gold.
Yes, well, we return to our so-called friend, Pliny the Elder.
Boo!
Boo! and he has quite a few chapters in his Natural History, which we talked about last time in biology, on metals and metallurgy. But he's not very consistent in his explanations. So he'll be like, here are the many uses of this metal. Here are the many ways in which you can use this, what's in chemistry called a catalyst. So an element that actually speeds up the process of making another substance. Anyway, so he goes through all of the different uses for these kinds of substances, these catalysts. And then he'll be like, here is the man in ancient history who had, well, for him, it was just history. But the man in ancient history had the most amount of gold ever. And here are the top 20 richest people of the Roman Republic. And it's a very odd selection of stories that he gives us. All of these different really, really useful and fascinating facts about how the Romans treated metal and how their technology was so advanced in terms of how they refined it and how they used it. And then he just does like Forbes 100 lists.
Oh, okay. related to the metals, or just like
they're thematically related? So if he's talking about gold, he'll be like, here is how much gold was in the Roman treasury in the year 276 BC. It's like, sorry, I did actually make that date up. It's just an example, but that's what he does. He's like, here's how much gold was in the Roman treasury. And it's like, I was just getting really interested in your whole stories about gold, but okay.
Sonia, they're just bonus facts. Don't worry about it. They're just extra special facts on the side. I quite like that, despite the fact that we don't like him.
Yeah, and he is very good at sort of putting all of these things together. Would you like to hear some examples of how he suggests refining some of these metals?
Absolutely, I would.
So he says for smelting copper and iron, it's best to use pine wood to make your hot fire. And he also says Egyptian papyrus is very good, but that was incredibly expensive, so that's not a very constructive suggestion. He says gold is melted most easily with a fire made of chaff. And if your fire gets out of hand in your smelting process, then it is extinguished most readily by the application of vinegar and unboiled eggs.
Oh, God, imagine the smell, the stench.
That's a fish and chip shop right there.
That's gnarly.
I don't know why he can't just put water on it. Like, but no
unboiled eggs.
I wonder if there's method to the madness, though, because gold needs a lower temperature to melt than other metals. So I wonder if chaff, being a sort of slightly less hot fire, might result in a good melt for gold. But then pine is a very oily wood, so that I can imagine that burning quite hot, because it's got that sort of extra oil fuel. So I wonder if there's method to the madness.
I think there is. This is the fascinating thing about a lot of Roman science, is like when you analyse it in hindsight with all of the different theories that we're aware of today, you know, that kind of scientific theory of this is why this does this, or this has these elements together as part of its makeup that will lead to this result, you know, that the kind of we can trace the cause to the effect much more easily. But in ancient times, they didn't necessarily have that sort of that method of deduction. They didn't have all of the research to put together. They didn't have all of that knowledge to understand exactly why things were happening. They just worked out by trial and error that this was the best way to do it. And when you think about the effort that goes into working things out by trial and error, it is so impressive just how advanced they were in terms of knowing the best way to do things, and having found that technology to such an efficient extent.
I just wanted to hop in and say maybe the eggs thing was to do with the fact that eggs can give off sulfur when they go off, and sulfur can extinguish fire.
I like how you're just still thinking about the eggs thing, Flo.
I'm really, like, just the world's most minging omelette produced by an out-of-control fire. Sorry, Xenia, you carry on.
Well, you're talking about sulfur there. We've got another thing called Greek fire, which comes much later in the Byzantine period. And we still don't know what it's made from.
Is this the thing that they copied in Game of Thrones, that's like a fire that sits on top of water and burns green or something?
Yes.
And it sticks to people.
It doesn't burn green, but it does stick to... So the green thing, that's Game of Thrones only. but it does stick to people, and it floats on water. And they think it must have been some sort of petroleum-based derivative, but it's definitely got some other things added to it that make it this kind of powerful substance, and they think that might have been sulfur or pitch or possibly quicklime as well, but you literally can't because it floats on water, you can't extinguish it with water, you have to use sand or vinegar
or unboiled eggs maybe.
Or unboiled eggs perhaps.
I find that really, really interesting that we don't know. I mean, we could probably reproduce it now if we wanted to, but we don't know exactly what Greek fire was made out of. Because is this against the law? Because I've heard recently that this is not true, but there was a whole thing about, Romans had a recipe for concrete that could set underwater, and we don't know what it is now, but actually we do know what it is. Or have I made that up?
No, so you're right, that's not against the law, that's true. So yes, they created Roman concrete. Is like one of the probably the best inventions of the entire Roman Empire. They were so sophisticated with their use of concrete and their recipe for it. So what they think happened is they used some volcanic material in with their concrete mix. And what happens then is that volcanic substance reacts with the seawater to make the concrete even stronger underwater. Whereas at the moment, actually, concrete scientists, I suppose, have real trouble with concrete and getting it to set underwater. They find it really difficult. And also it has a really negative effect on the marine environment. It's very, very polluting. Even today, when we're trying to sort of evolve our building methods to make new buildings more eco-friendly, we're still struggling with just how carbon intensive making concrete is. But the Romans had this method that worked with the environment as opposed to against it. And that's something we can actually learn today from the Romans.
I bet there was some lime involved. Everyone loves a bit of lime, don't they? We all love a bit of lime.
They did love lime, and they had so many uses for lime, which was good because they made quite a lot of it as a byproduct from quarrying, I think.
That's fabulous. You can use it to dissolve a body. Talking of building materials, it's just got a myriad of uses, Meg. I just thought I'd throw one in there that you might be able to apply at home. Talking of building materials, Enya, I'm interested in glass, because what's that? That's sand, isn't it?
That's right, yes. So, yeah, I mean, Romans, concrete and glass, they would be so at home in, like, Dubai today. They'd just be like, yeah, we can do that, easy. So, yes, Roman glassmaking really took off in the 1st century AD. Its basic product is sand, and you just heat up sand really, really hot, and then it melts, and it makes glass. So the kind of chemical name for sand is silica. And now in its natural state, that contains certain impurities, which is fine. Like even that impure substance that will still make basic glass, but it might have this weird sort of blue tinge. And in very early glass, you can find that blue tinge. But then again, just by trial and error, what the Romans did was they added some of these purifiers and catalysts, and they tried different ingredients in their glass, and they were able to not only to colour it, but also to make it colourless. So they were able to purify this glass to a really amazing extent. And again, when you kind of break it down, the ingredients are so simple. It's sand and it's salt. That's the purifying agent, or specifically natron, which is also used in Egyptian embalming. So they'd get that from Egypt, and then they'd mix that with the sand, and then they'd heat it up to make glass, and you get this really beautiful, high quality, clear glass product. But yeah, so once they'd worked all of that out, you know, how to add different elements or different compounds to add different colours to the glass, they could then start doing all of these different types of patterns and styles. So you get something that's called millefiori, which is where they have all these kind of tubes of different coloured glass. So they make all of those first, and then they put them all together and they melt them together, and you get this kind of stripy effect. Or sometimes you can then cut through, you can put beads together to make a dotty effect. And then you can do this other really cool thing where you make a plain bit of glass, so just like a normal base, and then you make a different coloured type of glass and you melt that into a sort of a frame on top of your existing glass bowl, and that makes that kind of two-tone effect. It's called enameling, and you put this extra design on top, like in Greek vase painting where you have red figure versus black figure, or sometimes you paint the white stuff on top. It was the same, but in glass. And like the technical levels required for that are so incredibly sophisticated. And as I say, the Romans were doing this without any theoretical understanding behind it. They just kind of worked it out.
That's so intelligent. And I was thinking as well that the fact that they thought to add things as well to the process to purify it, I suppose you'd end up with a load of slags.
You slag. Xenia, I think there was glass in Mesopotamia like thousands of years before that.
Spill the tea, Barney. Spill the tea.
Actually, there's glass on the Ulliburan shipwreck where the copper and tin were. Glass ingots, when it was shaped into little sort of round discs, and that's sort of dark blue, not really what we'd think of as glass at all.
Okay, so that's the kind of impure, like basic stuff.
Yeah, I think that's probably the distinction that's being made. And I mean, gosh, like that Roman glass is incredibly beautiful. But yes, there was a sort of a proto-glass industry in Egypt as well, and they'd imported that technology from Mesopotamia, but this stuff was a lot darker. There's actually a precursor to glass that was very popular in ancient Egypt as well, called faience, which is, again, nice and blue. And that's sort of, it's like silica, again, that's sort of not, it works in a cold way, and it's not heated to the sort of extreme temperatures required to make transparent glass. So you get this this opaque ceramic material, basically. And they made a lot of things out of faience, including, famously, these little shabtis. A shabti is a miniature version of yourself that you would be buried with. And they're sort of like little mini-me's that perform tasks for you in the afterlife.
That's cute.
That is really cute. I want one.
They're really wonderful. And people would be buried with hundreds of shabtis, between 300 and 400, ideally one for every day of the year.
Is faience what that famous hippo is made out of?
Yes, I believe so, yeah. Is that in the Louvre?
Don't know. We had a middle-aged lady come to us, my primary school, and she brought round a replica one that we could hold. And Daniel, whose surname shall remain redacted, just in case it follows him, attempted to lob it at our teacher. And we all thought it was the real thing. She acted like it was the real thing. So that wasn't helpful to answer your question of whether it's in the Louvre, but it's definitely not in a primary school in Wiltshire.
It's good to know.
Confirmed.
Start narrowing it down.
So whilst we're on the topic of ancient Egypt, Xenia, when she was talking about glass, mentioned this substance, natron, which I think is a really, really interesting little piece of Egyptian history. Natron is a salt used in embalming. It dries out bodies, basically. And this was a big part of Egyptian mummification, because you've got to get that body dry if you want to live forever. But the meaning of the word natron, and in Egyptian, the word is netcher, it means holy or divine. The idea being that this was the salt that made you into the divine being of the mummy. But it's also the etymology of our element, nitrogen.
Oh, what?
Yeah, so there's a little bit of ancient Egyptian in the word nitrogen, and it means divine. So that netcher works its way all the way through to us today. Confusingly, though, there is no nitrogen in natron. Natron is sodium carbonate.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was a misunderstanding.
Nice.
Yeah. And nitrogen itself is a much later French coinage, the gen part being like generating, like making something that makes nitre.
Etymology hour.
Big etymology hour.
Do we have any more etymology while we're here?
I've got so much, but maybe I could pick out a couple of gems.
Give me a taste, just a little, just hook me up.
Just
need a fix. I just need an etymology fix.
Give me some etymology. Okay, well, Barney just said gen, so hydrogen is an obvious one. Water, hydro, and gen is a exactly Greek word. Genesis is the same, like the beginning, the origin, the making of. So water former, water maker. Helium, helios, sun. Lithium, lithos, stone. I'm just going to rattle through them. Neon is a cool one. Just means new. Just a new element.
Oh, let us guess. Let us guess some, Meg. Let us guess some.
Okay, what do you think chlorine comes from?
Oh, what? Chloros. Chlor.
Yes.
Okay, green. Something to do with green.
Yeah! Well done.
Are you serious? Oh my God! I'm learning.
That was amazing. You got it like in one. Chloros is a Greek word meaning greenish yellow. We definitely spoke about it in our colour episode, the kind of confusing colour terms. So it could be like blonde hair, straw, but also green stuff. So yeah, that's chlorine. What do you think argon comes from? This is cool.
Argonauts, like people who live on Argos, maybe?
Argonaut is a ship, nauta, called the Argo. So that's slightly different.
Okay.
Argon is actually, it means like no work. So A, again, is that sort of negating A, like I was mentioning earlier. and ergon is work. So it's like, no, not working. And apparently it's because it's inert. It doesn't sort of react, I think. Again, my chemistry is not up to scratch for this. Okay, just got a couple more for you. Chromium is just from chroma, meaning colour. Phosphorus, I think this is really cool. Phos is light, and ferro is a verb meaning I carry or bear. So phosphorus is a light carrier.
That's lovely.
Does anyone know the other word that would translate as light bearer?
Lucifer.
Lucifer! So Lucifer is the Latin translation of phosphorus. So lux in Latin is light, and ferro in Lucifer is the exact same word, ferro. It's from the same root.
It's very fitting, because if you put phosphorus in water, it sort of reacts quite heavily and burns very brightly. And I'm sure if you dunked Lucifer in some holy water, you'd do the same.
Mm. Precisely. Many similarities.
Have you ever heard the conversation about things you can be mongers of? Like, you know, cheesemonger, ironmonger, warmonger, those sorts of things. I think a much neglected conversation is things that you can be a fur of, like Lucifer, Aquifer. And my favourite, Christopher.
Oh, nice. Christopher.
Nice.
What about their cousins, the duct, aqueduct, viaduct? You know, I feel like they're sort of in the same family, the furs and the ducts.
Exactly, yeah. Get rid of mongers. We're all here for furs and ducts.
So with all these crazy inventions like underwater setting concrete and dichromic glass and gold, do we have anything more interesting? Like, I want to know how we can make a philosopher's stone, or how we can turn, you know, lead into gold. Barney, alchemy, is it like the wizards that I'm imagining?
Not exactly. No. Alchemy is sort of our modern word for non-scientifically based chemistry. That's sort of slightly more like magical, natural philosophy driven.
Holistic chemistry.
Science. Holistic chemistry.
That's good.
But the alchemy is ultimately the origin of our word chemistry, that chem at the start being the important part there. We get alchemy in English from Arabic, which is alchemia, via Greek. And I was looking into the etymology of the Greek, which is obviously not my ballpark, so I didn't want to step on any toes. But I'd seen there was quite a lot of discussion about whether or not the word chemia in Greek comes from the Egyptian word for Egypt, which is Kemet. Which would make it sort of like the Egyptian art, which gives it this sort of like vaguely occult feeling. And I suppose even, you know, from Greece, where they would look to Egypt as exceptionally ancient, this sort of like this magic that had been passed on from this precursor civilization. But I'm not so sure about that. So I would happily sort of leave the etymology just at the Greek there. But yeah, so I mean, alchemy, unfortunately, isn't quite as exciting as these more sort of occult associations that it later comes to have of sort of transmuting metals and stuff like that. And, you know, alchemical texts that you might find in the ancient Near East are often just, you know, here's how to make some sort of silica-based product, throw a bunch of metals into the sand and whatever. So not really as exciting as turning frogs into gold.
It must have been very exciting at the time, though, to just experiment with substances and then see what you could input and what process you could apply to them and see what the output is, because it's kind of a whole new world. It's unexplored, it's undiscovered.
I would also like to apologise to our listeners who've tuned in for an ancient history podcast and have found themselves in an intense etymology podcast.
I don't apologise. Deal with it. It's fun. So thank you, Barney, for crushing my hopes and dreams about what alchemy is, and it's not actually wizards in long, flowing blue and purple robes with little stars on them. Why were there always little stars? Anyway, I'm going to think now about my favourite things that I've learned from this podcast, and to stick with the theme from last episode, I'm going to go with myself first. I liked guessing correctly that chlorine comes from chloros, and that I guessed that it meant green because it meant that I was learning things. But Meg, I am going to come back over to you for your favourite thing that you've learned today.
My favourite thing was actually Barney's fact about the etymology of nitrogen, was it? Remind me what the like other word was that isn't actually nitrogen, Barney?
Natron from Nature.
Natron. Yeah, very, very cool. Absolutely love that. Love an etymology.
Ooh, natron. That's a reference for some of our ancient viewers there. And apparently all these losers on this podcast who understand that reference as well. So Barney, over to you. What was your favourite thing that you've learned?
I today really enjoyed hearing about the incredible Roman inventions and Xenia explaining the sort of ingenuity and sustainability of Roman cement. I think it's really wonderful that this technology was sort of perfected 2,000 years ago and we haven't sort of managed to top it in modern times.
Yeah, we need to catch up with our ancestors. Come on, guys, get it together. Xenia, your favourite thing from today?
I really love the little faience shabtis. It's kind of that natural early glass, and I just love the idea of having a little helper for every day of the year of the afterlife.
It's like having one of your like Snapchat or Facebook avatars or a me from the Wii U, isn't it, but in real life.
Yeah. Very much, yeah, the me of the Egyptian world.
That's what it is. So on that lovely note, you can join us next time for we can get physical on the next episode of Against the Law.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, you can always choose to support us on Patreon.
We've got all sorts of tiers for every budget, starting from just £3 a month. Benefits include getting each episode a day early, stickers, and your name in cuneiform.
You can find us on Twitter at Against Law, and you can also find us on TikTok at Against the Law Podcast.
We're also always happy to hear suggestions, questions about the podcast and other requests. If you want to email us, our email is againstthelawpodcast@gmail.com.